thank you so much, Rabbi Auerbach, and thank you so much, Rabbi Rakoff, both of you, for the tremendous work you've done in guiding Reach Press in these past few months. And it's a particular honor also to welcome members of the Arbisfeld family who are here in this Arbisfeld Yom Rishon. My tremendous love and appreciation for Rabbi Chaya Arbisfeld, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was tremendous, and I miss him every day, and I'm so grateful to have the family support and to know that going forward. And also wonderful to be able to welcome my mother and my entire family here as well, and to try to say a little bit about this book, which is harder than it seems. So when people ask me what it's about, I say that's actually the hard question, and that's actually what the first few pages try to address, that it's hard to find a good word that I'm comfortable with to address the subject matter. And I'll start with what it's not about. I'll start with what it's against. And that is cynicism. Cynicism is a tremendously damaging trait. In fact, here we are in Adar, there are those who identify Amalek with cynicism. It's Chazal's reference of Eletz. And the idea of one who is impervious to all influence and doesn't think anything is important, doesn't think anything is serious, doesn't think anything is true or meaningful. And that quality is so damaging that Bali Musar, the great ethicist, writes that all of the Musar in the world cannot overcome a little bit of cynicism. A little bit of cynicism makes everything else impossible to get through and to enter. And that's a topic which sometimes surrounds some of the themes that are dealt with in this book. So we talk about, for example, Mechiras Chametz, which is perhaps the most well-known of the topics, and other related approaches which are sometimes seen as a workaround or an evasion or some type of an avoidance of the halacha, perhaps with some justification, sometimes without justification, and sometimes somewhere in the middle. So I wanted to try to address that in one volume, to try to look at all of these different approaches. Some are more well-known, some are less well-known, and to try to give somewhat of an approach to explain why it is that something like Mechiras Chametz, for example, has maybe a history of controversy, but today has wide acceptance, even though there are various attitudes in terms of how it's accepted. There certainly are those who don't sell their chametz. There are certainly those who are careful only to sell certain types of chametz, and there are those who completely embrace the sale of chametz. While on the other hand, a few years ago, we had a Shemitah year, and the topic of the Hetz Mechira, of selling land in Israel in anticipation of the Shemitah year, is something which has been controversial now for more than 100 years, and just kind of gets more and more controversial each time. It's somewhat of a perpetual motion machine of machlokas. There always seems to be more to argue about. So to try to explain a little bit why it is that some of these approaches have become more accepted, some have been less accepted. Nowadays, we're all comfortable with the Siyum on Erev Pesach to address the idea of the firstborns fasting. They generally don't fast, they go to a Siyum. May be surprising to know that beyond 200 years ago, that was actually more controversial than the Siyum during the 9 days, which today gets a little bit more of a mixed reaction. So there's a history of different reactions to all of these things, and I wanted to try to explain a little bit why that is and why some are treated differently than others. And first and foremost, so that there shouldn't be cynicism, there shouldn't be an attitude that either what we're doing is a joke or is a workaround, is a loophole. It's a word I don't particularly love either, as I try to explain a little bit, and try to address how these approaches develop and why some of them have become more accepted and why some have been less accepted, so that we shouldn't either have a cynical attitude towards them when we do them, or we shouldn't avoid them because of a attitude of cynicism, or we shouldn't develop a cynicism for the whole system, which sometimes also emerges. And often you hear the question, well, if they could do this, why can't they do that? If you can handle this, is there a way to deal with anything if you're motivated enough? And that's a big part of what I wanted to try to address, and for there to be a better understanding of through going through all of the various approaches and seeing how they emerge organically from the halachic system and how that plays out in the different details. There's a joke, they say, that the rabbis are going to prohibit smoking, but the Orthodox Jews aren't worried because they'll just sell their lungs to a non-Jew. Yeah. So for the record, we should note that that doesn't work. But the question of why it doesn't work and what exactly that joke represents, that's also something that hopefully emerges from the content, and hopefully we get a better understanding of why that is. So I'll go through the various topics in a moment and try to share a little bit of the approach, but we try at the beginning to suggest somewhat of an algorithm, somewhat of a formula, how we can predict what will become more accepted or less accepted, or what can influence within the system in order to make it more appropriate or less appropriate, again, to fight against cynicism. And a major theme that emerges as well, for me at least, is a real insight and a real view into rabbinic responsibility throughout the years and throughout the centuries. And if you read some of the literature, a lot of which I was seeing for the first time in terms of some of the details, you see just how much the rabbinic leadership was engaged with the issues of the time, with what the people were struggling with their religious concerns and their economic concerns and their social concerns, and how could we create a system that would be true to all of those things, that would address the Jews in their present state and give them the ability to function at the maximum of spirituality and at the maximum of economic stability and social stability, and address all of those at the same time. And the attention that rabbinic leadership played throughout the years is very, very surprising, perhaps, to those who weren't aware of this, but certainly inspiring and certainly elevating, and gives us a new respect, I think, for the system and for its guardians and for its defenders and for its practitioners. And for that alone, I thought it was worthwhile, at least for me, to write the book for myself, but hopefully you'll have a similar experience if you are able to read it, and to see just what were the concerns and what were the sensitivities and what were the approaches of rabbinic leadership throughout. So I'll mention what that, just to give a little bit of an overview, I'll mention what I think the formula has been, and then list the topics that we spoke about to give a little bit of a taste. At the end, so I had a chapter which I thought was very important to address for a number of reasons, and that is that we know that one of the major issues that we struggle with in society today within the Jewish community is the plight of the aguna, is the question of recalcitrant spouses not giving a get, and how can that be dealt with. And so often the question is asked, well, if we could figure out mechiras chametz, if we could figure out prosbul, so then there must be a way to address that as well. And it's an understandable question, especially prosbul is something which has been very much misunderstood, I think, throughout the generations, exactly how it operates. So my hope was that, first of all, by the time you get to the last chapter, there'll be a greater appreciation and awareness of the challenges of the systems and what can be addressed and how it can be addressed. But then also the fact that, here I'm referring to a bias here, but the Beis Din of America prenup, which is a institution that I have an association with, so I admit to a bias. I'm a student of rabbis who have created and have advocated the use of the Beis Din of America prenups, acknowledging that bias up front. But that should be presented in the context of the whole history of these challenges. And I think there are also aspects that can be used to emphasize the value of that particular approach of the prenup that aren't always highlighted, that haven't always been used in the advocacy, and that one who sees the whole picture here will hopefully come to appreciate just why it is that that has emerged as such a powerful tool, both in terms of its effectiveness, but also in terms of other aspects which speak for it and which show its particular strength in this area. And then there's a summary, and then there is an appendix, because there are some other topics that emerged in the middle that were also of great interest, one that I felt was particularly fascinating and worthy of a mini project on its own, so it ended up in the appendix, is the utilization of a statement of the Rambam, actually also in the context of Gittin, that the Rambam has a position to explain why it is that even though a get, the husband can only divorce his wife of his own free will, it has to come from a voluntary place. And yet, there are situations in which it is acceptable to coerce a husband to give a get. And that seems like a blatant contradiction. And the Rambam explains the way it works, that when the halacha actually requires this get, when it's a mitzvah, so then the reason it's valid, even if the man is saying he's not interested, is because we assume deep down, he really is interested. Essentially, the Pintaliyid concept, which sounds like a Hasidish idea, but was expressed by the Rambam hundreds of years before Hasidus was founded, that inside every Jew, there is the desire to do the right thing, there is the Ratzon to carry out God's will, even if outwardly they're saying otherwise, and we're just trying to tap into that and to bring out that free will that is really there as an expression of the desire to do the right thing. And what's really fascinating is that that principle, which the Rambam innovated in that context, was utilized by Poskim throughout the generations in additional contexts, also as a part of their effort to address societal issues. And, for example, if the question would come up, so let's say you have a Mechiras Chametz, where one or the other parties doesn't necessarily believe in it, doesn't think that they really care about it, so should it still be valid? And many thought, no, it has to be taken seriously, without any cynicism. But there were those who argue that even if the individual is saying, I don't really believe in this, I don't think it really means anything, but if the halacha is going to be better addressed through this, then we assume that the inner Jew really wants to do the right thing, and there is a way to validate the approach through the usage of that Rambam. So there's a fascinating literature that is existing throughout the generations since the Rambam wrote this, and there's an appendix at the end focusing on that, on both the sources of the Rambam. Many assumed it was connected to Matan Torah, so we read about the past 2 weeks in Yisro and Mishpatim, possibly serving as the basis for the Rambam's position, and how that's been addressed. Some interesting Divrei Torah about how that's exactly been considered, the episode of Matan Torah, Nasa V'Nishma, and the Rambam's principle. So that was the appendix at the end, highlighting how Poskim have absorbed the messages of that Rambam and utilized it and applied it in some surprising ways, and what exactly that has meant through the generations. So to go through the general content with a little bit of an overview, what I think emerges, if you look at the literature, is that there is essentially an algorithm or a formula that has four parts to it. It can be divided more. Questions, some of them may be lumped together in ways that are a little bit arbitrary. But I think there are essentially four distinct parts. And the parts can explain why one approach will be more accepted or less accepted, because each one of them is highly variable based on circumstances and history and all the other details. And if you look at this formula, you can get a good picture as to the logic of the system, as to why it is that some approaches will have more support and some will have less support and some will be somewhere in the middle and some will be highly circumstance and detail dependent. So what are the four parts? So the first part is letter. So the letter of the law. So the first is the question of whatever approach we're talking about, is that effective by the standard of the letter of the law? If you sell your chametz, does that indeed take you out of the prohibition of owning chametz on Pesach? If land in Israel is sold, is that indeed successful in addressing the question of Shemitah? If a prosbul is written, would that indeed mean that the loans can still be collected after the Shemitah year? So there is the question of the letter of the law. And of course, that has to be addressed in its fullest sense. Otherwise, it's really a non-starter. The whole assumption is that we are at least following the letter of the law. So that sometimes is a topic of debate to assess whether or not the letter of the law is fully being addressed, or in a way that is at least arguably being addressed. So that's the first part of the formula. Question of the letter of the law. And that actually has two halves to it, because one question is it effective? So if you sell your chametz, does that indeed accomplish the goal of addressing your need to get rid of your chametz before Pesach? So the effectiveness is one aspect of the letter of the law. But also, sometimes it's a question of permissibility. It may be effective, but it's a question of whether or not it can be done. So, for example, in the context of selling the land in Israel for Shemitah year, so there was two halves of that debate. There were those who felt that it wasn't effective. It wouldn't accomplish removing that context from the prohibitions of Shemitah. And there were those who felt maybe it was effective, but it's prohibited to do. That there's a prohibition to sell land in Israel out of Jewish hands, and therefore the letter of the law has to be addressed from both halves. Would it be effective if it's done? And even if it's effective, maybe there's a prohibition involved. So there are two elements or more to the question of letter of the law. So that was the first part of the formula. Second part of the formula, and also the third part of the formula, they're related. Both sections of the formula have to do with spirit. So the question of, does this fulfill the spirit of the law? And that's often the dominant question, because usually if we feel a little bit uncomfortable about one of these approaches, it's because we suspect there's something on the spirit of the law angle. So the question of, yes, okay, maybe technically I am crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's, maybe technically I am following all the letters of halacha, but somehow I've gotten around things. Somehow this is not really what God wants. This is not the Ratzon Hashem. So that's the next question. To what extent does this satisfy or depart from the spirit of the law as we can best perceive it? Now that itself is somewhat speculative, because we don't always know what the spirit of the law is. Sometimes the Torah tells us what the spirit of the law is. Sometimes we're somewhat speculating and guessing, but that itself may be a mitzvah. The idea that we need to try to figure out for ourselves what the spirit of any given halacha is, some suggest that that's actually a mitzvah, because we have a directive of kedoshim tiyu, we have a directive of yasisa hayasher v'hatov, and the Ramban comments over there that those are directives to follow not only the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law. So the Bali Musa write that it's apparently a part of our obligation to try to understand what a mitzvah is getting at, and whether or not we are satisfying that. So the fear that we might be following an approach which is satisfactory as far as the details, as far as the letter of the law, but is somehow avoiding the spirit of the law, that's a major consideration. And I think you will find that to the extent that the spirit of the law is more satisfied, there's more acceptance. And to the extent that there is a greater departure from the spirit of the law, there is less exception. Less acceptance. And part C, which is also about the spirit of the law, but in a different sense, is how sincere are you in what you are claiming to do? So, for example, if you're selling your chametz, or you're selling the land in Israel, is it genuinely being sold? Or is that somewhat of a charade, somewhat of a sham? So the spirit of the law in that sense, that when you're representing that this is actually a certain type of action, and maybe the details, the letter of those actions are being satisfied, but is there reason to suspect that it's not really sincere in terms of whether it actually is how we are representing it? And that's also a major element of discussion. So when we talk about that original line about selling your lungs to a non-Jew in order to address the prohibition of smoking, so why is that not effective? And for the record, it's not effective. Don't try that at home. But why is it not effective? So it fails both on B and C. Because as far as the spirit of the law, in terms of what is the goal of what we're doing, if we assume that smoking should be prohibited because it's dangerous, so selling your lungs to a non-Jew is not going to mitigate that danger at all. You'll have the exact same problem, just calling it something else. So that's a question of spirit of the law in the second sense. Is this a evasion of what the Torah really wants in that context? And that's a word that would be appropriate for that question, the question of is it an evasion or not. The next question, the question of spirit of the law in terms of how you're representing it, so to say that you are selling your lungs to a non-Jew, would that really mean anything? If you are going to claim you're selling your lungs, but you're going to keep your lungs inside your body and walk around with them for the rest of your life and still breathe through those same lungs, to claim that they've been sold in any meaningful sense is itself highly suspect. So that's part C, the question of you're claiming that something is happening. Is it really happening? Is that actually taking effect in any meaningful sense? And that also becomes one of the major metrics that is a part of it. And specifically, if we talk about Mechiras Chametz, where there was a tremendous amount of debate over the centuries, to a point now where we're somewhat at a little bit of a consensus that there's a role for it somehow, whether you sell actual chametz or not, but at least the idea that it's a part of our lives and our schedules has been accepted to a large degree. So you have both of those issues being raised. And a part of what hasn't always been noticed is some of the arguments about Mechiras Chametz throughout the years, they're actually arguing on different points and kind of passing each other in the space. So, for example, if you look at B and C, so one question about the appropriateness of Mechiras Chametz is the assumption, which we have to question whether this is an appropriate assumption or not, the question of, are we evading the Torah's intent? When the Torah says, get rid of our chametz, do not own chametz on Pesach, and here we are, instead of burning it, we're choosing to sell it, and with the knowledge that we will be reuniting with this chametz after Pesach, and it doesn't actually leave our homes for the most part, so is that somehow evading what the Torah wanted. When the Torah said, don't own chametz on Pesach, so are we saying, well, we technically don't own it, and that's all? Or is that an evasion of what the Torah is asking for? That's one question to ask, which was a topic of some debate. But what really drove some of the earlier objections was actually not that. It wasn't so much that there was a concern that this would somehow evade the Torah's intent. It was rather the belief that the sale wasn't genuine, that it wasn't actually sincere, and that you were claiming to sell your chametz and not actually doing so in any real sense of the word. And if you could satisfy that, then there wouldn't necessarily be an objection from those corners that it was somehow evading the Torah's intent. So it's really two separate questions, and that goes to also the issue of what is driving the debate that surrounds some of these approaches. And the last factor, factor D, which has always been an element of these discussions, is the question of need. How much is this necessary? So is there really a need for this? Is there a great economic pressure? Is there some other great societal difficulty in carrying out the Torah's instructions as they were otherwise understood? And to the extent that the need is greater, so then we can do with less satisfying answers on the first three questions. So if there's a tremendous need, so sometimes that drove an approach that wouldn't necessarily have been as intuitive as far as the first three approaches are concerned. And if the need isn't great, so then we have to be much more satisfied that we are addressing both the letter of the law and the spirit of the law in both senses of the word. So these four questions, these four parts of the formula, the letter of the law, spirit of the law in terms of are we evading God's intent, spirit of the law in terms of are we honestly representing what we're doing, and how necessary is this, those four aspects are a part of every discussion here, and I think we find that if we ask these four questions and we'll look at them with a honest perspective, then we get a pretty consistent answer in terms of understanding why one approach is going to be more successful, more accepted, why one will be less accepted, why it'll be somewhere in between, or why certain variables make a huge difference, and how that has emerged in the historical debate. And the historical debate, in particular, in some of these areas, is tremendously fascinating. I tried to bring that out a little bit when that was relevant. So just to quickly note what some of the chapters are about, and then if there are any questions, be very happy to take some questions. So, hi. Yeah. So they're both about the spirit, 2 and 3. But the second question is, are we evading the spirit of the Torah's requirement somehow? The Torah really wants us to do this for that reason, and we're doing it, but not fulfilling that reason. That's one type of spirit of the law. And the second type is, usually it involves representing an action in a certain way. Is that a sincere representation? So to use the chametz model again, the second question would be, are we avoiding the Torah's real intent by selling the chametz in a way that allows us to reunite with it after Pesach? 2 and 3 are subsections of spirit, right? 2 and 3 are both connected to spirit. So the question of intent of the Torah and what are we representing? And the fourth, the question of need. So what are the topics that we spoke about? So the first chapter is about ribbits, is about interest. And here, again, there is a tremendous history to the literature in terms of how what's known as the Heter Iska developed. That, on the one hand, the Torah is very strict to an extraordinary degree in prohibiting any interest. If you loan money, you're not allowed to take any extra at all. It's a very absolute prohibition, so much so that the rabbis added on many layers to the prohibition. It's a tremendously intense prohibition. And nonetheless, what emerged primarily in the past 500 years, really since around the 1500s, is an approach called the Heter Iska, which is really meant specifically for business loans, for loans that are not necessary to pay the bills, to pay the rent, to pay for groceries or medical expenses, but are there to help with investment. So there, that has emerged as an approach where essentially who would be the lender is now transformed into an investor. And the borrower is now transformed into a partner who's working on behalf of the investor. And what would be interest is transformed into profit from the investment. So how exactly that emerged has a tremendous history to it. Also has a history of going from much less acceptance to pretty much across-the-board acceptance today. So the question of why that is and how that emerged. And I think there especially, you can find a consistent pattern in terms of how the spirit of the prohibition of ribbis was understood, that it was primarily for chesed loans, that somebody is in dire straits and can't pay their bills and needs to borrow money. It was a topic very much in this past week's parasha. The prohibition of ribbis is also in this past week's parasha in Parshas Mishpatim. And it emerges pretty powerfully that the Ratzon HaTorah there, the spirit of the law, was to protect the ability of the needy to get loans without any interest, and the emergence of an economy that was so focused on capital and investment was a major shift in society and also reflected different types of purposes. So as far as the letter of the law, that could perhaps be addressed separately from the spirit of the law, and that's a part of what's discussed there. In addition to that, a very fascinating development of the past, just almost 100 years ago exactly, there was an initiative of a great-great-grandson of Rabbi Akiva Eger to try to get everyone to write once in their lifetime a declaration of Iska, that all of their interactions would be with this understanding. And there was a really fascinating, I thought, controversy that surrounded that. Would this be good for the Jews? Would this be bad for the Jews? Would this enhance the observance of this prohibition? Or would it diminish the observance and the awareness of this prohibition? And the nature of the literature back and forth is, again, a window into the rabbinic responsibility and the sensitivity and the question of what is best for all of the different factors of Jewish life and how that's addressed is a worthy experience in and of itself. So that was the first chapter within these chapters. The next chapter deals with the whole notion of sales, the idea that sales is ever used to address halachic questions, and how effective is that? Again, is there a genuine aspect to these sales? Is there an artificial aspect to these sales? Does it depend on what we're talking about? Are some more than others? For example, in the case of chametz, you'll see that a part of what dictates the acceptance is that there are a number of reasons to feel that the sale when it comes to chametz is more genuine than the sale when it comes to land in Israel for the Shemitah year, and that's probably a major part of why there is a very different reception between the two. So that next chapter is about sales in general, and then leading into a devoted chapter to the sale of chametz, which goes through the whole history of how that starts from a Tosefta and then develops to a widespread practice, which is the source of controversy. And again, the argument that is it a genuine sale, or even if it is a genuine sale, does that evade the Torah's intent? And we provide an argument why maybe it doesn't at all evade the Torah's intent. But then the far more complex discussion of stores that continue to open and operate and sell chametz on Pesach, and the tremendous controversy, which is a whole different level of controversy, about selling those stores chametz, and that there's a whole other chapter's worth to say about, so we try to address that also, and a very different perspective about rabbinic responsibility for the community as a whole, and what would it do to the community to have a store claim that it sold its chametz while it's operating and selling bread to customers of all faiths throughout the course of Pesach. So what does that do to our appreciation of Mechiras chametz? There were rabbis who were tremendously against that, and there were rabbis who advocated very hard that this should be accepted, including the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and others, and the whole nature of that discussion and what exactly that represents. And this is one of the contexts in which that Rambam and Hilchos Gittin is invoked, that even if they don't say they mean, and even if they're not religious on the surface, but they really want to do whatever is the best for halacha, however we can make this the best possible solution, that's what they want to do, and we can assume sincerity because of that Rambam and Hilchos Gerishin. So all of that brought into that discussion. So that's the next chapter, and then we go from there to Shemitah and the Hetem Mechira, which itself was, again, its own fascinating world and highly relevant now in terms of the efforts to try to preserve settlement in the land of Israel, both before there was a state, after there was a state. How has this changed after there was a state? The strong feelings that it changed in both directions. Those who argue after there's a state, then there's no need or appropriateness or even possibility of a Hetem Mechira. Those arguing very much the opposite now that there's a whole national economy that depends on it. So all the more so we need the Hetem Mechira. And quoting directly from the writings of chief rabbis in the past few years and how they struggled with this question, should we continue doing the Hetem Mechira, which was started 100 years earlier, and at one point it had the strong advocacy of Rav Kook, but Rav Kook also wrote that he didn't want to go into too much detail because he didn't want it to be a permanent approach, and he wanted it to be something that would be revisited from every cycle again and again. So all of that history and all of that back and forth is a crucial part of that discussion. And then the next chapter is one of the most misunderstood tools within halacha, even though it's one of the most rock solid, because it has has the pedigree that is higher than all the others, and that's the Prusbul. The Prusbul, which goes back to the Mishnah, it is a Takana of Hillel. Couldn't get better Yichus than that. And yet, the Prusbul is one of the most misunderstood concepts. The Prusbul taken as an example of how, if there's enough motivation, you can avoid and work around the Torah, and the rabbis just wanted to help out their rich friends and make sure that they could collect their loans at the expense of the needy poor. So the rabbis were motivated to that so they could get around Torah law, and we try to right away address that almost every word of that sentence isn't true. Probably not Torah law nowadays. That wasn't the motivation, and that's not what's going on. And there's so much more to understand about how the Prusbul emerged. Again, going back to the Mishnah and why it has been held up to the extent that it has throughout the generations, but to understand what the Prusbul represents and what its message is, that's also something that thought was a crucial exercise for me, and hopefully should be worthwhile reading. And then the next chapter is also something which has taken a major shift, and that is the question of inheritance. If you read the Torah, so there's very clear rules for inheritance, that the eldest son inherits twice of the portion, the other sons only one portion, and the girls don't inherit at all. And contemporary practice has sharply veered from that, and with very strong endorsement from almost all rabbinical voices, and some report that this is true in every segment of the Orthodox community, that it is widely accepted now to use what's known as a halachic will, however exactly it's formulated, the different ways to do that, but essentially that results in equal inheritance for all the children, boys and girls, firstborn and non-firstborn, and that seems on paper, literal paper, to be a direct evasion of what the Torah commands, and yet it has received wide endorsement from rabbis of all stripes, and in fact strong encouragement from rabbis of all stripes. So how exactly that developed and why that's acceptable and why that is considered to be within the spirit and the letter of the law is another topic of great interest to me, and I wanted to include that as well. And then the topic of siyumim, the question of whether or not it's acceptable to make a siyum to address certain restrictions regarding eating. In the case of Erev Pesach, it's a fast for the firstborn. In the case of the 9 days, it's a prohibition, really a minig, not to eat meat or drink wine during those days. And nowadays, it's also, right now, I've alluded to this before, but nowadays there is a lot of controversy that surrounds having siyumim during the 9 days, even though in summer camps and in bungalow colonies they're widely accepted, but there are those who are very skeptical about how that fits the mood of the 9 days. And yet the siyum on Erev Pesach, at this point in history, there's really no question about it at all. It happens in every shul pretty much. Multiple siyumim on Erev Pesach, I think, pretty much in every shul. And there's no questioning of it at all. In fact, some have gone so far as to say that this is a new minig. There is no longer a minig of fasting on Erev Pesach, but instead there is a minig of having a siyum, and that becomes the focus. A fascinating development, but if you go back 200 years ago, not much more, you go back to the Chassam Sofer, the Noda Behuda, they were highly skeptical about the siyum on Erev Pesach, and it was clear they had a very different practice. So how exactly that emerged to take on a different kind of understanding, that is the next topic. And then the question, the chapter we mentioned before, halachic prenuptial agreements. So hopefully by the time you reach page 212, so hopefully there will be a little bit of a framework to understand why this is such a challenge, why this is of a very different nature than all of the challenges that were addressed, however they were addressed in the previous chapters. And nonetheless, the emergence of a prenuptial agreement, of which there actually are many types, and I don't try to address all of them because that gets into all kinds of other complexities and detail, which is focus on one of the approach, but we should acknowledge that there are other approaches and there are other prenuptial agreements. We focus specifically for purposes of convenience and focus on the Beis Din of America prenuptial agreement, which has also had its own controversy. We try to explain and to address those controversies and to give a little context of what its strengths are together with the controversies and why perhaps there are strengths here that haven't always been appreciated and realized, and hopefully that should at least be a part of the contemporary discourse and an understanding of how that can impact our societies in ways that go beyond Gittin and those unfortunate situations. And then after that, there is a summary, a conclusion, which tries to put it all into perspective, and again, to emphasize our goal of avoiding all cynicism and preserving a structure that allows our spiritual lives to express themselves in the most appropriate way, fashion, from all of these perspectives. And then the appendix, which goes to a little bit of the literature that surrounds the position of the Bechor Shor, who maintained that all of these approaches should only be acceptable for rabbinic law, not Torah law. There was a tremendous debate about that, so it's an appendix devoted to that topic. But then, at much more detail, the appendix devoted to the Rambam's position of the Pintel Yid and what that Pintel Yid has meant to rabbis throughout the generations and to the scholars throughout the generations, and how that has emerged as a core element of rabbinic thought and the approach to addressing the issues within our communities. So I hope that gives somewhat of an overview and somewhat of an interest. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to try to. Hi, how are you?
First of all, I'll give you a plug for this book. I picked it up only a few days ago, and I haven't been able to put it down. It's outstanding.
And that's the whole question.
That's no question whatsoever.
Thank you so much. It's just the record, he's not planted. She's definitely not planted. Thank you so much. Very appreciative.
My question is, you have A, B, C, D.
Yes.
In terms of the methodology. Perhaps it's in the second half of the book, which I haven't gotten to yet, but why isn't there an E which would say that if the underlying law that is being circumvented is not relevant, then there should be less of a problem in accepting a circumvention? And I'll focus on the obvious one, which is ribbit. So that one, the underlying purpose is really not relevant. Anybody will tell you in the business world, and in fact on page 31, you do bring the Torah Tmima, who says, so it's not just, you know, somebody like myself saying it. He says, however, once the economy transitioned to a commerce-based one, there was now reason to borrow funds that was not connected to an existential need, and there was similarly an opportunity cost imposed upon the lender. As such, the same ideal of living with you could, at least in spirit, accommodate a rationale for the borrower to pay the lender. So perhaps you mean to include it under spirit of the law, but it seems to go beyond that and to say, when the underlying law is no longer relevant, then there should be less of an issue in doing so. Now, you do address on page 23, Darshin and Tama Dekra, and maybe that's involved as a problem. But I was also concerned that there were no footnotes to the Torah Tmima to say that others picked up on that approach, and was it that he was in the business world and others were?
Which he was. He actually worked in a bank.
He worked in a bank,
right?
Yes.
So let's address that for a second. Let's use that specific example to address that. So you're right that is included in the spirit of the law. But it's important to emphasize, because this could easily get lost, that I think the spirit of the law is the determinant factor in that issue, that when it comes to business loans, the assumption of many is that indeed that was completely at odds from the intent of the Torah. But to say that it's not relevant anymore, that would certainly be an overstatement, because it is relevant to loans of need. Right, so there's a huge aspect of relevance in there.
But there's a new element.
Right, so that new element.
Irrelevant.
Right, so that new element, I tend to agree with you that it's less relevant, but I'd be a little bit more cautious saying absolutely, because there is somewhat of a discussion about it, but I think you're right in thrust, which I think does explain the wide acceptance of it in the business context, because I think the assumption is that you're right on paper, that when we focus on a business loan, which certainly are not the only loans that we're talking about, so certainly the Torah's intent is highly relevant still, Bezman Hazeh, but it's just in the business context, when a loan is for the purpose of an investment, so then it does seem to be very credible and very well-founded to say that that is different from the Torah's intent. So when it comes to a loan for paying the bills and for buying medicine or for paying the rent, so then yes, the heter isko was not meant to address that. And in the context of a business loan, so then there is tremendous foundation to say that this is very different from what the Torah had in mind as the Torah Tumim expressed. And that's why it's been so accepted in that context. But I should add that there's still room to be cautious, because first of all, we mentioned Darshinat HaMidakra, the whole debate in the Talmud of to what extent do we ever have the right to assume we know what a mitzvah is about and to apply it in that context. So here, a word of caution, first of all, because as Rav Kook discussed that concept in the context of the Hetter Mechira, and he invoked it in that context, but to note also that we still had to address the law anyway. So we couldn't say that, well, the reasoning doesn't apply, so therefore we can dispense with the mitzvah. We still have to stick within the letter of the law. The question was, okay, but if I know I'm sticking with the letter of the law, do I then have the right to do something which seems at variance with the spirit of the law? Does that run afoul with this idea of Darshin and Time Midakra? And there he noted that that itself seems to address the spirit of the law, so we should have the right to factor in both. So it's a major part of the discussion that whole Darshin and Time Midakra issue. But a part of the hesitation that comes from that is, as much as we might feel like we know the spirit of the law and we may feel very confident about it, there's always a little room to wonder. So, for example, in the context of Ribbis and the Heter Iska, there is still some room to find variant opinions. So, for example, there were those who discussed whether the Heter Iska could be used even for Chesed loans. So there was a major debate as far as that. Poskim such as Rav Moshe Feinstein were tremendously against that and spoke very strongly against that. But there were a history of Poskim who had a different attitude. So exactly how the spirit of the law goes in the lenient direction, on the one hand, was a little bit of a debate. But there were those also who weren't 100% convinced that we totally address the spirit of the law, as much as I do think there is a compelling case. But if you look, for example, in the writings of Rav Shamshon Nefal Hirsch, he has an unusual explanation of the purpose of Ribbis, where he specifically does address it in the context of business loans, which is, I think, unusual, but it exists as an opinion. And also something that the Chafetz Chaim seemed to address in his Avos Chesed, which is a little bit vague the way he puts it, but it seems like we're saying that if you're going to have the ability to lend money with interest in a business context, so that may address the spirit of the law in one way, but may hurt another way, because if the purpose of the Torah is I should be giving loans out for free to people who need it, so okay, I won't charge those people if I lend them money, but how much money will I have to lend people who need it if I also have the opportunity of lending my money to a businessman and getting interest? So if I can profit from that, that might be legitimate in and of itself. That might not be a violation of the spirit of the law, but that may divert money from the possibility of chesed loans.
That shows they don't understand business.
Maybe.
Because they would have more money than to...
Yes, if they're successful, right. And if they're successful and if they appreciate that. So if they have the mentality that, okay, I'm doing this, but it also preserves my ability to continue to engage in chesed, so that would be a crucial thing. But it's unclear if you can always rely on that. But it's true that what you find in dealing with Ribbis and Prizbol, the common element between the two of them, is that there was a meta value that seemed to dictate the attitude in both cases, and that it seemed that Poskim in both cases realized that the Torah is most concerned that poor people should receive loans. The people who are in need should have access to loans. And while there are principles that are there to support the benefit that they would get from these loans, there was always the concern that they may be counterproductive, that they may just convince people not to lend in the first place. So that's the major motivation behind Prizbol, to make sure that as important as the idea of canceling loans in Shemitah is, it's still less important than making sure that loans were issued in the first place, which the Talmud identifies explicitly as the motivation behind the Prizbol. And it could be that that's also a major factor when it comes to Ribbis also and Heter Iska. So in fact, Rav Asher Weiss, who has, I think, a different angle on this subject of Heter Iska, he presents it very differently than I do. He takes the presentation that essentially Heter Iska is a way that they got to be comfortable taking Ribbis, that it was essentially Ribbis and they came to accept it. So then the question is, so how does that work with the spirit of the law? So he's presumably focusing on then the spirit of the law is to make sure that the needy get loans in the first place. And if people are not going to lend to the needy because they're not going to get any interest, so then we'll have to find a way to make sure they'll still provide loans. So it's a far more begrudging acceptance then, in that perspective, saying that really this isn't what it's about, but it's needed for society to make sure that the highest priority is there, that the needy get loans, and therefore that became a different level level of acceptance. So it's a different attitude. So
being
there are
beside the Torah Tumah who is explicit.
I think there are different ways to be. So, example is one contemporary sefer that I happen to like a lot, where it's called Beis Matzis Yo, where he pointed out that in what's described in the Torah, in the context of chesed loans, so there a person is already in need. He can't pay his rent. He can't pay his bills. And if you're going to charge interest, so he couldn't pay in the first place. Now he's got to pay you too, so you're pushing him further in the hole. But if somebody says, listen, I don't have any bills I can't pay, but I have a big business opportunity, and I want to make money off of the money I'm going to get from you, so then the person, in spirit of the law format, has the right to say, okay, listen, if you're going to make money with my money, I'd like a little piece of it. I'd like to join in that making money. So that's a little bit of a different approach than the way Torah Tumah expressed, the same kind of idea, that's just simply the idea of shifting from a loan, which was only going to fill a hole that the borrower had, and then they'd be further in the hole if they had to pay you also, to a situation where the borrower is going to use your money to make more money, and therefore perhaps it's very appropriate that they should share that profit with you. And that reflected a shift in circumstance. So, hi.
Conversion law.
Which law, sorry?
Laws of conversion.
Conversion.
Yeah.
So that is a huge topic and a huge issue of controversy, and I think also reflects the sensitivity of rabbinic leadership throughout. And if it was a topic I'd go into in greater detail, I would try to point out that I think it's an area where you really can understand both sides of it. You know, those who are stringent for very easily understandable reasons, that they could easily see the religion becoming diluted to the extent that it becomes meaningless, while those who take a much more lenient opinion, it's also easily understandable why they're driven to do so in terms of many social challenges that are particularly relevant in the state of Israel today. So I think that's a controversy where the sensitivity of rabbinic leadership on both sides is actually very apparent and very easily accessible. The issue really isn't one so much of workarounds, a question of just whether one takes a more lenient or a more stringent point along the spectrum. So it wasn't really an issue where a new approach developed to do things differently, more a question of just what position does one take along the spectrum, which may be highly influenced by all kinds of concerns that are of great moment. And therefore, from that perspective, it does have a lot in common with these subjects, and a lot of the same attitudes emerge in the debate about these subjects. But it doesn't per se contain one of these new methodologies that are found in some of these other subjects. But the argumentation behind it is very parallel, very much related. Okay. Any other questions or thoughts? Okay, well, I thank you all so much for coming. I hope you find some value in this. Also, if you would like